The New Quantum Era,
a podcast
by Sebastian Hassinger
and Kevin Roney. Welcome back. This is now part two of our conversation with Joe Fitzsimmons of Horizon Quantum Computing, based in Singapore. If you're the kind of person that likes hearing the entire context, we would encourage you to listen to the prior episode. But if you just want to jump on in, please feel free to continue. Without any further ado, here it is, the second part to our interview with Joe Fitzsimmons.
It's interesting to me, like that feels like the evolutionary path of this turning into a technology is in that interplay between the theorists and the experimentalists, right?
Yeah,
it's the two sort of, you know, main tribes of physicists working around and through each other's breakthroughs to arrive to something that's actually, that becomes a useful tool. So really, it's a fascinating process.
It really is. I mean, maybe my knowledge of history of early technology developments is flawed, but I have the impression that lots of the early explosive eras of invention, I mean, electricity and silicon,
sure,
many of them were personalities just in that mid-range. I mean, both theorists and experimentalists. These entrepreneurs who somehow took bits and pieces of both cultures and ran with it. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, to your point, Joe, like you can only go so far with sort of the elegant understanding of the theoretical foundations of a field, that you have to then build it and see how well your predictions turned out, and then adjust. Right. I mean, and then the great thing is, as you're saying, there's all these strategies that emerge from the ground truth of the actual physical object that gets produced, and the lessons you learn from operating it. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we see this from a different direction as well in Horizon. So, I mean, you know, my group was a theory group. We're a software company, and I guess it's often seen as software and theory being kind of hand in hand. But the gap between a paper and an implementation in software is enormous.
Yes.
I mean, there's plenty of things. I mean, even within the company, you talk to people and they say, oh, it's known how to do this. There's a big gap between it is known and anyone being able to actually do it.
Yes.
So, I mean, we see this all the time. Like, an example of this is the HHL algorithm. Right. So this is a algorithm for estimating expectations of the inverse of a matrix. So you're trying to invert some matrix A, and you want to compute something like X transpose A inverse X, or maybe the trace of A inverse or something like this. It turns out you can do this in polylogarithmic time, whereas classically you would expect it to take about time that scales with the cube of the size of the matrix. So there's an enormous quantum advantage to be had here. Mm-hmm. It turns out to be really widely applicable. There's lots of machine learning models where this is an important step. There's lots of other applications in engineering domains and in all sorts of different domains where this is important. But it turns out the algorithm is relatively straightforward. You simulate the evolution of your matrix A as if it was a Hamiltonian, which is something we know how to do in principle. And then you're going to do that in a kind of controlled way off some other register that's going to tell you how long forward to evolve it for. But that register is going to be in superposition. We know how to add a control, more or less. So you're going to run that forward for some amount of time. and then you're going to do a quantum Fourier transform, and then you're going to rotate an ancilla qubit by some angle that's going to depend on the arcsine of something that's spelt out in qubits. Huh. And all of that seems reasonable. You can explain all of this. It's a few lines of pseudocode. Each one of those lines is extremely difficult. Okay, the quantum Fourier transform is straightforward. I can write down that circuit. That's no problem. Hamiltonian simulation. So simulating e to the minus iat for some value of t and some matrix A, that's difficult.
That's to compute the unitary transformation from the Hamiltonian. Yeah, okay, right.
Yeah. So it's an active area of research how to best approximate this if you have.
Yeah, and in theory, it's such a concise and powerful expression. But yes, I mean, in practice, it's a handful. Yeah.
So we know roughly the complexity of doing it, but actually the best way of doing it is, you know, something that has gone through many steps, gone through quite a lot of evolution over the last number of years. But even the simplest thing, rotating a qubit by, you know, you want to rotate one over a number that's spelt out, you have a number that's spelt out in qubits, and you want to rotate an ancilla qubit by an angle that's given by the arcsine of 1 over that number. That should be easy, right? On a classical computer, it's really easy to compute.
Sounds easy in Python, right?
Yeah. So, you know, what do you need to write down? You need to write down, you know, like A cos 1 over whatever the number is, and that's it. It'll
right.
give to you. You know, what's the quantum circuit for that? Like, that's really tricky.
Having the faintest idea, my God. Yeah.
I mean, how would you even approach doing it? Yeah, you can look it up. Some people have written research papers trying to explicitly write ones for it, but, like, that's a tricky step. Now, it's known, right? Because we know you can compile C. We know that classical computing is equivalent to classical reversible computing. And we know you can write this in Python, so you must be able to write it as a
quantum circuit. So there must be some way to get it done. Yeah, right.
There is some way, but what is the way? And exactly how many gates does it need?
Right. And is it a combination of the like how big the circuit is and how complex, or is it just the complexity of actually formulating the circuit?
Oh, so I mean, just... I mean, even just coming up with the circuit, it's something that is tricky. So, like, one of the things we focused on that we've been building into our system is just the ability to compile from C. So you write some code in C, and we can compile it to some gates. And that's okay, because there's, like, you can compile C to a compiler IR, and then there's only so many operations, and if you know how to do each of these operations, well, clever people have already figured out how to compute sine in C and so on, and you can start taking advantage of the existing libraries.
It's fascinating. So that's one of the core technologies, right, of your operation. Yes, it's these compilers that have this broad fluency for compiling down to these alternate architectures. Do I have that right?
But I mean, this is certainly part of our system. But I mean, just in terms of the barriers, in terms of the things that, you know, are seen as, you know, known how to do, but like the gap between the theoretical result that, yes, it's known this can be done in polynomial time and actually doing it in polynomial time, you know, in some concrete number of steps, that's quite a big gap.
And is it your thinking that you would compile C to quantum gates and then start to optimize? You'd have something that runs, and then you'd start to optimize the implementation to try to get to sort of the best performing.
So what we do at the moment in the system, so we showed off a first look at our IDE at Q2B last month. Oh, sorry, actually, we're February now, so I guess in December. what we showed in that was a basic, like, quantum programming language. So it has the same kind of flow control as BASIC. along with the ability to include subroutines written in C or C++. So you can just import what we call a C2Q file that tells it how to interpret a function within a C file as a subroutine within your program and what optimizations to make. And when we run through the compiler, it generates the full circuit, you know, map it down to whatever hardware we're targeting, but it takes care of that construction for you. Mm-hmm. So like we've been trying to build the tools to bridge some of these gaps. Ultimately, where we're going is to try to automate the algorithm construction as well. So at the moment, we're not accelerating the C. So we're just constructing the reversible subroutine. We're optimizing it, but we're classically optimizing the gate set.
Okay.
We're not constructing a quantum algorithm for the same task. Now,
gotcha.
There are some optimizations where we where it is kind of a quantum version, but it's not. There's no like polynomial speed up. We're only talking about constant factor speed ups at the moment. So you know that side of things. That's just pure classical compilation with some kind of clever constructions of quantum gates and so on. But that's ultimately what you're doing at that level. We're targeting above that. So we're targeting automatically accelerating the programs as well. And, you know, the way to do this is essentially if you look at any piece of computer code, like for the most part, you can compile it down to assembly, where basically you have a bunch of jump operations. So there's some flow control, and then you've essentially blocks of assignments that are getting evaluated. So you've arithmetic expressions, for example, you've some circuit to be evaluated, and then some flow control graph that you're moving around that's telling you what's the next piece of the circuit. And it turns out you can accelerate both of these on a quantum computer. So it's known that that circuits can be evaluated faster, at least certain types of circuits can be accelerated. And again, with the flow control, you can use Grover, Grover-like algorithms and things like this to also speed that up. So,
interesting. Wow.
When you start looking at it from this perspective, it starts looking like quantum computing is very broadly applicable. I think this is part of my, it's part of my outlook on quantum computing, why I'm so optimistic about it, because I really see it as being applicable basically everywhere. Now, there are some things we know we can't accelerate. We know that if you're trying to compute the parity of a string of bits, for example, it's hard to do better than the best classical algorithm. And that's because the best classical algorithm is so good. But if you pick a really hard problem, for the most part, we tend to see some kind of quantum acceleration. Even if you take ones where we can't make them polynomial time, but you take some NP hard problem, very often you see at least a square root acceleration for a quantum computer.
That's a very bold claim, Joe, because I mean, that's certainly,
it is.
You know, there's sort of one of the themes of the hand wringing about, should we be investing so much time in quantum? Is it ever going to turn out to be as good as we think it is? People tend to point to like the quantum algorithm zoo and say, there's only, you know, whatever, a dozen or less, eight really solid algorithms there that are proven to be advantageous. But you think it's much more broadly applicable.
There are hundreds of algorithms on the quantum algorithm zoo.
Okay.
What I would say is that there are only a small number of tricks we know of.
Yeah. Okay. Moment. Yes.
So there's only a kind of. I mean, I guess you can categorize different quantum algorithms by what tricks they're using. And so there's Fourier transform based tricks like period finding and different things like this. There's amplitude amplification, and that gives you both gives you kind of Grover search and also gives you quantum walks and things like this. There's kind of adiabatic stuff, and there's various different categories that you can come up with. And there's
topological algorithms as well.
Yeah,
that there is some significant phase in that direction. Yeah.
There's not all that many different techniques at the moment, but each time we discover a new technique, we get lots out of it.
Got it. So they're not recognizing how broadly applicable those basic techniques are. Got it.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're in a situation, like if I gave you a magic technique that said every time you write a for or a while loop, it's going to take only the square root of the number of evaluations you require classically, then it doesn't matter that that's only one thing. It's right. just applicable to everything.
Yes.
Right. Unless you've
so that's really interesting, Joe. You're almost positing a possible future where, you know, as an average everyday workaday coder, you could just, while you're compiling your code for a for loop, invoke an optimization that would just automatically, you know, accelerate rapidly, right?
So minus this is Q. What been going
yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
So this is what we've been trying at Horizon. You know, it's a long path to build a system that can do this. We've had to build up the ability to compile, you know, pieces of classical algorithms, you know, pieces like classical subroutines to be able to come up with our own quantum programming languages that can incorporate these, but that are Turing complete. So we're not just compiling circuits, because one of the things you immediately run into is what do we do about while loops? Because, you know, everything you run on a quantum computer today is essentially a circuit. But a while loop you can't write as a circuit for the most part. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what are you going to do about that? You just can't encode a Turing machine as a circuit. So we've been building up those tools.
You need some sort of control structures is what you're saying.
Yeah. So we've been building up those tools. We've built up already some demos where we automatically refactor a subset of MATLAB code and construct quantum algorithms from that. So pulling apart loops into simpler and simpler elements, recognizing which each of these simple elements does and replacing it with a more efficient way of doing the same thing. It does not accelerate everything. There are certain kinds of elements we don't know how to accelerate, but there's lots we do know how to accelerate.
And that might be, I mean, I wonder if that's another theme in your sort of reasoned optimism, is that I don't know that people are grasping. This goes back to what I was saying about sort of shooting for that, you know, Shore machine, let's call it. People don't really recognize how much we can get out of these early stages if we're implementing classical and quantum in a hybrid kind of architecture, right?
So I want to be a bit careful here to not mislead people in terms of my own beliefs. There is quite a big effort to gain an advantage with near-term systems that have high error rates or have moderately high error rates. So that where at least where errors are still present.
It's called the NISQ era.
And personally, I'm skeptical that we will see many NISQ applications. I would absolutely believe that it's possible to see one for chemistry. Don't believe about general optimization. I think that's...
If I could just chime in on that very point, because, I mean, we've been, of course, watching this NISQ phase and heard many people speculate about the plausible, ab initio quantum algorithms translated onto NISQ-era hardware with even a small number of qubits making big breakthroughs. But just in the last year or so, I mean, there's gigantic and radical evolutions, right, in molecular geometry algorithms for classical computing, where they've, you know, many chemists have just abandoned ab initio techniques for classical computing, and they're just using, you know, ML techniques and huge breakthroughs. I mean, it seems like there's a possible conclusion in the minds of some that the threshold for quantum advantage in chemistry is receding.
Do you
at all agree? Yeah.
So I'm not a chemist, so I'm not really well placed to talk about which are the easy to simulate and which are hard. My understanding is that certain classes are relatively straightforward to model on classical computers and you can get good results from. But with, you know, different ways you can go depending on certain, when certain elements are included, can make it difficult. But also the other side of this is things like large flexible molecules and things like this. And how the modeling of that goes. So, you know, whether ML techniques there lead to accurate predictions or just plausible looking predictions.
Yeah, right. Always the problem.
So I don't know what way things get there.
The ultimate fake until you make it technology. Yeah, exactly. ML is just like, I mean, it looks right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. So this is something that was done, I think, quite a lot in the film industry with water. So when you're simulating, when you're like rendering a sea, an ocean or something like this, that actually simulating the computational fluid dynamics for that is really difficult. But you don't need to, you just need to make something that looks oceany.
Right.
And the same with fire, right? Like you want to simulate fire. Yeah. Like that's a really complex simulation, but you don't actually need the full simulation to fool a person because a person can't tell.
Just to make a good movie, but if you want to do real physics or engineering, it's an entirely different question.
So I found that kind of interesting when I saw that there was some like cut down version of fluid mechanics that was being used in some movies to give like very realistic looking scenes. But it's obviously like this bit of foam here actually would not be here, right? in reality, So it's for chemistry. And I just don't know where the lines lie. I'm not a chemist.
Right.
So I don't work on chemistry algorithms either. But it seems very plausible to me that that is an area where we would see an advantage because the systems are just so analogous, right? I mean, you're using a quantum mechanical system to simulate another quantum mechanical system. That quantum mechanical system that you are trying to simulate out there in the real world is subject to noise as well. It's interacting with its environment.
Exactly.
So you would expect to be able to make predictions where even if the noise is present, if you can shape it in the right way so that it looks like environmental noise, that particular atom would be seeing or that particular molecule would be seeing, then you would still expect to have good advantage and get great predictions out of it. So that seems plausible to me. Because nature has noise in it too. So as long as you can just shape the noise so that they match, then it seems plausible to me that things work out.
But for the more broad sets of advantages that you were describing, you're thinking fault tolerance is sort of the base
noise.
Requirement. Or low
noise.
Yeah,
so let me say low noise regime rather than fault tolerance. Okay. But where your likelihood of having errors is relatively low, or the number of errors you're having is relatively low.
I guess at that point you can actually design around that with sort of the logical construction of your programming. Like you can, if your errors are fairly rare, then you can have safeguards in your code for the error.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah, so you don't necessarily need to do everything fault tolerantly if you know that your errors are rare. There's some nice results as well on like what happens if you only have to protect against memory errors rather than processing errors, different kinds of things like this.
Well, first you need memory, as you pointed out.
Sure, but the memory could just be qubits that you're not dealing with at the moment. In general, I think it's the case that in the NISQ regime, we have limited evidence that there's speed up from the existing algorithms for real world problems. And when you're in that regime and you're hoping that quantum computing will offer an advantage, I think there's a danger of the power of wishful thinking taking over and that you convince yourself of applications that are not going to going to materialize. So I'm not a big believer in the power of wishful thinking, even though I'm extremely optimistic about the future.
And then I think that was exactly the what you conveyed in your Twitter thread, just to come back full circle. I mean, if we go back to where you were saying, the co-design, essentially the interplay between our theoretical models and then running on real hardware is what's going to lead to that at least the precipice of a breakthrough that you can then apply industrial scale to and industrial scale capital to. It feels like that's really the lens that the NISC era needs to be seen through, is like, this is a necessary collaborative project to get to the point where we can actually launch a viable technology that makes a big difference to a large number of people.
Yeah, I mean, like, people aren't, you know, no one is going to build a quantum computer in their shed and have it take over, you know, all of the high performance.
I don't know. I've seen some movies from Marvel that would suggest otherwise.
So, I mean, I'm not saying that it's not possible that at some point someone will build a quantum computer in their shed. What I am saying is that, you know, current state of the technology, if you want to be at the forefront of what's possible, it's really hard and quite expensive.
Big team, a lot of capital, no other way at this point. Yeah.
And we need to go through these steps. There's not a fast forwarding. We can't just jump to a trillion qubits or something like this.
Right.
But, you know, and maybe the line is different. So, for conventional computing, it had to be people, right? Like, that was the benchmark. Maybe people with mechanical calculators or something like this. Like, that's what you need to beat, and log tables, right? If you can beat that, then you're useful. So, you know, you see it for sorting data, first of all, I guess. Like, if you go to the Computer History Museum, you see all these punch card machines that are used in the census and stuff like this. You know, by the time you get to the, you know, into the Second World War, you start seeing, you know, the first computers being built to, to start breaking codes, essentially, and then other uses.
But, and simulate physics.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. It's exactly the same. Like, I know. If you wanted a reason to be optimistic, like, what are the very first things that conventional computers are used for? Like, breaking codes and simulating physics.
Yeah.
You know, what history are the first...
History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Yes. So I've got some slides that I show on the timeline of quantum algorithms and classical algorithms. And, like, you see them. Like, you see all the sorting algorithms as well early on and things like this. And, like, well, Grover Search is quite like that. And you see... you see, like, hashing, and you've got quantum fingerprinting, and you see, then you start seeing linear algebra stuff, and you see, we've got all of these, you know, HHL methods for fast linear algebra and stuff like this.
Interesting parallels.
And even machine learning. You think of machine learning as a very modern occurrence in computing, but the McCullough-Pitts paper on the artificial neuron is from 1943.
Amazing.
So, like, it's right at the start. So even this QML trend that you see, like, also has echoes in history. And, like, you know, when that's starting, the number, like, the amount of memory of any of these systems is small.
Tiny, yeah.
Right? It's more than the number of qubits we had in early systems. But now we're getting, you know, now latest IBM chip, I guess, is 433 qubits, something like this. We're expecting to see thousands in the next couple of years.
That's right.
Like, if you go to the Computer History Museum, you can see, like, a kilobyte of RAM.
That's right.
You know, you can see the block. You can see a ferric hand core memory.
Hand-sewn cores,
Exactly. So we're getting to a point where the quantum computers are comparable. You know, there's maybe a notion that classical computers were, you know, didn't have errors, but they did. You know, okay, maybe the errors were different in nature and so on. And certainly our thresholds for fault tolerance and error correction are different. But you're still getting into this regime where the devices are starting to look like computers. And actually not even very old computers. They start to look maybe not that dissimilar from the kind of processors that were, you know, the first Intel processors and stuff like this. And that's not 1940 or something, right? That's significantly later. And, you know, okay, they're noisy still. if we can get down the noise, and maybe we do need to go to full tolerance to squeeze it all out, maybe we're able to do some other tricks in terms of decoupling and other kinds of forms of protecting qubits that reduce the noise low enough for us to be able to do interesting things. Mm. Or maybe we see things like the kind of bosonic encodings that have come up in superconducting systems in recent years.
Right.
And we start to see more progress with error correction using less physical hardware than is otherwise required. So you don't need 1,000 physical qubits. You maybe need lots of levels, but it's still the one, the transmon and cavity mode and so on.
Right.
Then maybe you're in a situation where things start to look pretty interesting. But the thing is, we're not competing against people. We're competing against computers now.
Computers.
And
yeah.
Computers do get better, and they get better quite quickly. So maybe where the crossover point is, it's not the same as it was for conventional computing.
Right.
So maybe it's not at the scale of, like an ENIAC or a UNIVAC or something like this. Like maybe it's further beyond that. Maybe you need a better, a more developed system before you get there.
Right.
But one thing we know is that it's really, really hard to simulate these systems.
Yeah.
Okay, we don't have an absolute proof of that, but we're about as convinced of that as anything.
Right.
So if you can give me a system with 10,000 perfect qubits, there is no computer on Earth. If you put all of the computers on Earth together, nothing can come close to simulating.
That's right.
Are there uses for it? For sure.
Right.
If you try to use it as an annealer, will it solve an optimization problem faster? Like, probably not. You probably need to put more thought into your algorithms than that.
Right.
But for sure, there will be interesting things it can do.
Interesting. Yeah.
So, when it comes to this situation on NISQ, you're right. It's something we have to get through. If there were commercial use cases at this scale, fantastic. And it would be a big boon for the industry, and there'd be money coming in, and that would drive things faster. But we have to recognize that there may not be.
Right.
That we may need to get to bigger systems. But we know that for bigger systems, there's definitely things we can do. Yeah. And I would argue that there's a very
just really interesting perspective, Joe, because, so many people have been focusing so powerfully on the NISQ era, trying to raise people's optimism there. But you're really pointing towards a brighter future farther out.
Yeah.
But, where there'd be a certain threshold of quantum error correction and qubit volume and error control that would really just open up a huge range of applications. And your historical background that justifies this, it feels like it's of substance. So now I want to politely corner you and ask you your point of view. I mean, would you be willing to speculate on the time frame in which you would really see a breakthrough, real live demonstration of commercially relevant, quantum superiority, quantum supremacy?
I
know that's a controversial term, and please forgive me for being so forward with this one. I had to ask.
Sure. So what I would say is, in some sense, fortunately, I don't have to, because I mentioned a report earlier in the podcast when about the timeline to breaking RSA
2048, yes.
And that does give time frames. So it asks people for their confidence level at different time frames, and it turns out that the majority of respondents switch from thinking it's less likely than not to more likely than not at the 10 to 15 year time window. So that's for breaking cryptography. I would say that you would expect to see applications before that. So you would expect to see, let's say applications outside of chemistry, I guess I would expect to see 2 to 3 years before you can break crypto with it.
Right.
Like the HHL thing, for instance. I mean, you think HHL would be a prime candidate?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Do you think the HHL algorithm would be a primary commercial supremacy candidate for...
So at the moment, the bottleneck in that, I would say, is Hamiltonian simulation. If we can get around that, then the algorithm itself is very compact. So you can do it on small numbers of qubits. Mm. So yeah, I would see if we can get a bit better at how we do, maybe if we eliminate doing matrix exponential. So it wouldn't be HHL necessarily, but fast linear algebra. Yeah, I can see that as being an early use case, accelerating linear algebra.
Uh-huh. And would you be willing to, again, speculate on a time frame for when that eventuality
that's
might
arise?
That's
pretty robust. I mean, that's not robust to noise. So that's, yeah. I mean, you're looking at fault-tolerant systems for that.
Right.
I would say you need probably, you know, kind of 100 fault-tolerant qubits, something like that. So similar time to the fault-tolerant chemistry advantages, I would say.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. But before our RSA, you think? Before
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say you can probably start seeing very interesting things on a system that is maybe about a 60th of the size of the one you would need to solve to break RSA 2048.
And so, in comparison to this this global risk analysis, global risk institution report that I think puts what you said around 10 to 15 years for
prediction. You can say what's Moore's law and work backwards from that. So how many doublings are in between? Yes.
I guess to your point about the power of industrial scale investment and capital mobilization, if we get a realization of fault-tolerant qubits, even in small numbers, that would be the thing that would motivate that level of capital investment. So from one fault-tolerant to 6,000 fault-tolerant is probably a lot faster than the road to that point.
It's hard to know. You'll run into issues. It'll depend on the technology. You'll run into issues with just the physical size of the qubits. Mm-hmm. So it may require miniaturization to take hold as well, to like get down.
Right.
You know, at the moment, physical qubits for superconducting systems are fairly large.
Yes.
I don't know, like, if you need to make 6,000 copies of the thing and have it in a giant facility, it might just be prohibitively expensive.
That's right. That's right.
Well, probably not, actually. I mean, I guess it costs a couple of million for an individual setup. So, you know, you can multiply that up. You're still well below a 2 nanometer fab.
Right. Yeah. Well, this has been an amazing discussion.
Really interesting. Yes. Thank you for your time, good.
This is exactly what I was hoping it would be, Joe. Thank you. This is an expanded Twitter thread into an hour of discussion, which is exactly what I wanted. Anything that you'd like to sort of end on, any last sort of observations or call to action or admonishment to just chill out and relax?
Now that I've publicly alienated all my former colleagues and also the people going after the tech industry.
Any bridges you'd like to repair?
So what I would say, what I didn't talk about so much here is, you know, from the industry side, it is really difficult to build quantum computers, right? So I really do have an appreciation for how hard the work of the experimentalists is in this. And I don't mean to minimize that at all. But what I would say is that to get to this future, there are different things we need to be working on. We're not currently working on them all. And it serves us to be optimistic about the future if we want to get there quicker. Mm-hmm. So you can look at the future. If you believe this is what the future looks like, if you take this optimistic view of the disruptive power of quantum computing, then it tells you there's certain things you should be looking at now that people are not looking at. No one works on data structures, which is insane. There just aren't data structure papers for quantum computing. There's like a handful. It's crazy. It's a massive part of algorithms. So when we talk
there's
about
also numerous prominent scholars who are sort of saying there's huge amounts of room for algorithmic development as well.
We don't look at the systems as anything other than monolithic chips for the most part. or like trying to network together monolithic chips into a larger processor. Like, we do need to start thinking about, you know, about how the evolution of this goes, how we make components that can work together. I mean, there's just a lot of scope in terms of things that are not being focused on at the moment that would be clearly needed if you are going towards a future where quantum computers start to look more like conventional computers. And I don't mean necessarily my MacBook or something like that. I mean, just even large supercomputers or whatever. Like, even if you want, you know, even if you're constraining it in that point of view, you still need them to be able to talk to the outside world. You still need... there's still lots of different things you need on that path. And yeah, I think I would stress that, you know, this future, if we're going to get there, it's going to be built by people, by optimists, right? It's not going to be built by people who accidentally discover it's possible.
Right.
Just because it takes such sustained effort over such
sustained
a long period
of time. Yeah. And I think your point, I think the point of having to think more deeply about that optimistic horizon of quantum computing, I'm starting to think maybe that's where your name of your company came from. It requires optimism and it required sustained effort over a long period of time. And what we see in the public discourse is often just too short term. It's either short term positive or, you know, overly optimistic, or short term overly pessimistic. Yeah. And really the ingredient that we need to try to eliminate is that short termism.
Exactly. And like, this is, you know, one of the reasons why doing, you know, for me at least, taking the startup path was the right route, because it gives you clarity of purpose. So when you're in academia, there's a lot of different things that are competing for your attention, lots of different projects you can be working on. And it's quite common to jump from one project to another. Certainly I did that a lot, worked on lots of different things. But if we want to get to a point where we develop something into a real technology, then it requires focus and sustained effort to develop it, not to the point of view of just showing something's possible, but to actually developing it into a real working system. And that can take many, many years of effort. You know, is that possible in larger companies? Sure, of course it is. But none of those companies are quantum computing companies. None of those companies have quantum computing as its core mission. So they can let go of it. They can decide that actually maybe, you know, maybe we're going to deprioritize it. For us, that is what we're doing.
Right.
And if it does not work, then the company doesn't work.
That's such a great articulation of why startups are so critical to any industry, but to tech in particular, because of that make or break, right? It's that level of investment in trying to get the technology over the hump into a product that actually people will pay for. And if you don't, that's the end of the startup. It's incredibly motivating.
Singular focus. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. We really appreciate this. We appreciate your time and your perspective.
Really, really great, Joe. Thank you so much.
Sure, no problem. Thanks very much for having me.
Hey, welcome back. Again, another fascinating interview. Sebastian, one of the things that really stood out for me from this dialogue, kind of a surprise, but it was to hear Joe's perspective on essentially dialing down the level of enthusiasm we should have about the NISQ era quantum computers. And he has a longer term outlook, which is quite positive, but he's skeptical about this NISQ era. I mean, I think just for the
benefit of our audience, we should be filling in our acronyms here to be right. more clear. But some people know this already, but NISQ stands for NISQ, Noisy Intermediate Scale Quantum Computers. And so that's right. the, I think, a fair description of yeah. many of the commercially available machines right now.
All of them.
Yeah, yeah. right, exactly. They've got high error rates and, you know, low coherence times and, you know, not very many qubits. But, right. you know, many people have been, I think, for a long time placing serious reputation bets, right, on thinking that there could be a quantum supremacy breakthrough in that category sometime within reach in the foreseeable right. future. Joe is pretty negative on that. And somehow,
he was.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and the phrase was coined by John Preskill, who's a professor at Caltech and quite well known in the field. And it was,
name, you know,
yeah, he's definitely a name. And yeah, he was thinking about a couple hundred up to a scale of a couple hundred qubits, but mostly not noise corrected or not noise mitigated. So, you know, the constraints with the length of the circuit and the depth of the circuit that you can, or length of operation and depth of the circuit you can run. And yeah, Joe was, there are a lot of people who are trying to use those NISQ machines in conjunction with classical in
yes.
Variational type settings, variational
sure.
quantum eigensolver, QAOA and others.
And possibly some ML applications as well. Yeah,
yeah. Right, and there yeah. might. And I mean, I still remain guardedly optimistic, but I think that where I definitely agree with Joe is that this era, this NISQ era, is necessary, right? We need,
sure.
and you talked about co-design, and I think that's a really powerful tool for advancing the technology where, you know, the experimentalists build the best machine they can, the theorists get to test out their machine, that machine, and frankly, the technologists, the computer scientists who are new to this whole endeavor get to also get their hands on real hardware and apply what they know about software engineering, complexity theory,
yes.
all of the
yeah.
other disciplines. It's one of the things that I find the most fascinating about the field is that interplay across domains in this co-design phase before, as we explore all the challenges to actually
no doubt.
Getting
yeah.
to that early fault resistant. I thought that was cool too. He called out fault resistant versus fault tolerant. So he
yes.
thinks that, you know, as the gate fidelity, as the noise gets better controlled and diminishes, the threshold for usable computational power drops as well. So he's kind of thinking, you know, noise resistant, not fully noise tolerant
right.
or
yes.
fault tolerant, which I think is. That was certainly a cause for optimism. And he was saying, I thought that was really an interesting way to sort of think of the evolution, right? So you've got the NISQ era, which is sort of a necessary experimental stage. You've got early noise resistant, maybe in the 100, 200 qubit mm-hmm. range, where
yes.
he thinks there'll be sort of niche scientific applications that come out of that. And then, you know, when you get up to large numbers of hundreds, maybe 1,000 noise resistant qubits, you get to the topic that you were really excited to get to, which is compiler design.
Absolutely. I mean, just it's amazing yeah. that he was able, that his startup and his team are working on like two incredibly hard and very interesting domains. I mean, one is, of course, quantum computing and those algorithms. The other is compiler design, which is never for the faint of heart, right?
Right.
But the intersection of like, you know, advanced QC algorithms together with compiler optimization, you know, in this the follow-on era after NISQ, I mean, he's asserting that there is a gigantic possibility, right, in about
yeah.
10 years or so, of being
yeah.
there being general purpose, right, optimization techniques for a compiler. Wasn't that amazing to compile basically optimizations of plain old everyday loops down into Grover's algorithm and similar?
Yeah,
yeah. It's like, wow. I really hadn't no idea.
Grasped
yeah.
that, and I'm guilty of actually like going to his website and seeing talks by his team and stuff at conferences. And I
yeah.
still hadn't fully taken that on board until he talked us through it. When he said, you know, whatever,
yes.
speeding up a while loop, like, you know, I was under the impression that there was these sort of big bang kind of, you know, Shores and Grovers
yes,
and things
yeah.
that were, you know, monolithic in his terms. He actually was also talking about system design and how everything that we're building now is monolithic. And he's thinking in a much more modular mm-hmm. and sophisticated system design kind of way, where, you know, I made the joke during the conversation, you can sort of throw a minus Q on your compiler flags and get the benefit of QPUs in the cloud doing, you know, optimizing your while loops. Like, that's just
almost
incredible.
Almost like an NVIDIA card or something, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So that was really, really exciting to hear. And I hope our listeners enjoyed it. And I also wanted to add a note for all our new listeners. We may have noticed a little bit of a spotty release schedule over the last couple months. We are still endeavoring for biweekly releases. So we're trying to do two episodes a month, and we're back on track. We had some logistics issues with some of the work that goes into actually bringing this podcast to you, but we've cleared those up. We've got a good pipeline of guests coming up. We're really excited about the shows that are happening in
there
the future.
It is. Yes, such as podcast life sometimes. There's interruptions, but we endeavor to do better. Yes.
That's right. Always.
Okay. That's it for this episode of The New Quantum Era, a podcast by Sebastian Hassinger and Kevin Roney. Our cool theme music was composed and played by Omar Costa Hamido. Production work is done by our wonderful team over at PodFi. If you are at all like us and enjoy this rich, deep, and interesting topic, please subscribe to our podcast on whichever platform you may stream from. And even consider, if you like what you've heard today, reviewing us on iTunes and/or mentioning us on your preferred social media platforms. We're just trying to get the word out on this fascinating topic and would really appreciate your help spreading the word and building community. Thank you so much for your time.